The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Kylie Reid's debut novel, Such a Fun Age, was a New York Times bestseller, named one of the best books of the year by a slew of publications, and was longlisted for the 2020 Booker Prize. Her other writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Playboy, and The Guardian, among other varied publications. She currently teaches writing at the University of Michigan. She joins us tonight with her new novel, Come and Get It. In a recent New York Times review of the book, Reid is referred to as a social observer of the highest order, as she tells the tale of an ambitious University of Arkansas resident assistant and her tangled relationships with a professor and three boisterous students. Here's to boisterousness. The author will be joined in conversation this evening with Naila Orr, a writer and story editor for the New York Times Magazine. Her work has appeared in the London Review of Books, the Paris Review, and The Believer, among many other places. Philadelphia, please join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here.
Ooh, hello. Oh, I'm supposed to read. Oh, my God. Okay. I'm going to read a little bit first. This is from chapter 2. Millie pulled out a chair. She began cutting out little cards that would go on the desk of each resident, green slips of paper with the RA on duty phone number, a crisis hotline, the dorm address, and so on. Colette got to work on the residents' door decks. Millie wished she'd observed Colette's handwriting before she'd given up this task. But when she looked up, she was promptly relieved. Colette had written the name Morgan on a pink inner tube, and her handwriting really was quite nice. It was as if she was good at doing an accent. The letter's curves were feminine and round. Millie crossed her ankles. So where were you last year? Southgate, it was such ass, we hated it. You and Rylan? Yeah, I'm hoping this will be a lot more chill. It will be. Students here already have friends, or they're on that housing scholarship, or they're in a sorority, which sounds annoying, but it's not because they're always out. Colette placed sunglasses, reading Kira to the side, holding the edges so the ink wouldn't smudge. I don't mind that. I'll be good as long as there's no freshmen and as long as I don't have to communicate with Joni. Millie laughed through her nose. Was Joni in Southgate with you? No, she wasn't, thank God, Colette said. But we both worked at Clubhouse Fitness last summer, and she was annoying for obvious reasons. But then, okay, so when the minimum wage changed from $8 to $8.50, I made this presentation on how I should be getting $9.50 because I was killing it over there. I got like 4 old people to start taking Pilates. I probably added years to their lives, and they love me, but whatever. Anyway, the management ate it up. They were like, ooh, PowerPoint, look at this initiative. And they gave me $9.16 an hour, which was dumb, but I was like, fine. But then Joni was like, how is that fair? I've worked here longer than you, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, Kate, you've worked here like 4 months longer, but if you want a raise, then go ask, loser. And she was like, that's not the point. That's disrespectful. At this, Colette looked up. With a Sharpie in hand, she did that quick, listless motion for someone jerking off. And she was just a huge dick to me all summer. She'd be like, hey, Colette, the spa water needs ice. Like, ooh, cool. Thanks for telling me. Millie smiled. That's really dumb, she said. I know, she's such a pill. She also got pissed because this one time, I don't even remember what I said, but I had always assumed she was gay because Colette lifted her shoulders, like fucking duh, and I said something about it, and she was like, what? Why would you say that? And I was like, whoa, my bad, but I'm gay, so chill out. But yeah, when I saw her name on the dorm list, I was like, wow, I'm going to jail this year. But then I asked Amy, who I was paired with, and I was like, okay, fine, she seems normal. At this, Millie experienced what she knew was a surplus of flattery and what felt like an adolescent intrigue at learning that Colette was gay. In order to not draw attention to Colette's gayness, something she hadn't considered one way or the other, Millie picked up another sheet of cards. I'll stop there.
Thank you for reading that that scene. It's such a wonderful passage, and I feel like it really just encapsulates the strengths of the book in miniature. Like, you get the sense of humor and the incredible voice, and, you know, one of the most persistent themes of the book, which is money and people's relationship to money. So that was sort of like a great, you know, encapsulation of what you do so well here. But I guess I wanted to start by, like, taking it back a little bit to your first book, which was set here in Philly. I think parts of it were set in Washington Square West, right?
Yeah.
And then Kensington.
Yep.
And you lived here for a while. And
I
then
did.
Now you live in Michigan.
It was for a job. I had to. Yes.
And you taught at Temple, right?
I did. And I enjoyed it a lot.
Okay. So I just wanted to start by just asking, like, what is it, how it feels to be back in the city after so long?
It weirdly feels really great. I still love Philadelphia so much. And just walking around downtown today, I thought, oh, this was so nice. It's a really great place to live. Of course, you go where there's a job, and I have a little baby daughter now, and you have to do what is stable for children. But I very much missed Temple students and being in Philly. It's very rare to have a walkable city in the United States, and that's something that's huge in Philadelphia. And I also love the energy here a lot. So if you ever want to come to the Midwest, that's where I am for now. Philly is a great place, and Philly also represents to me the first dip I took into seriously researching for a project. Mm-hmm. I didn't live here when I was working on Such a Fun Age, and that was a Hanukkah present for my husband to me. And I came here by myself and walked around, and I had a friend who went to Temple, and I felt like, okay, this is where Amira would go, and this was the first big research trip I ever took, and it still means a lot to me.
Yeah. I went to Temple, so I was really excited to see Temple represented so well in your book. And so the first book, obviously set in Philly, and you move the action for Come and Get It to the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, Arkansas. What interested you? So between both books, you sort of had this interest in campus life.
Yeah.
What appealed to you about campus life?
That's a great question. So I've lived in three college towns now. I lived in Tucson, where I grew up, at the University of Arizona. I lived in Fayetteville. I'll get to that in a second, too, for 1 year. I went to Iowa, and I guess four cities now, in Ann Arbor as well. I lived in Fayetteville from August 2016 to August 2017. My husband had a job there at the law school. I had just gotten rejected from 9 grad schools, and he said, do you want to come, like, try again? And I was like, sure. So, and it worked out, thank God. But I just worked at a coffee shop and wrote articles for a small magazine there. College life is really interesting to me, because most people who go to college think it's like, that's what you're supposed to do, and that's the next step. And that wasn't until fairly recently. College wasn't the thing that you had to do for a job until maybe 50 years ago or so, when it started becoming more popular. I know a lot of our parents went to school because their job paid for it, and they went at night, and it's like this now accepted way of a transition into adulthood. I think transitionary places are really interesting, and especially when you're bringing all the values that you learned from home into a tiny dorm, and you're learning in real time if you're gross or weird or cool, and you're kind of changing personalities, and you're learning so much, but you're also bringing everything from home with you. And so I liked the idea of a dorm being this hothouse for interacting with all those things, particularly money. I watched a lot of dorm tour videos on YouTube. There are so many dorm tour videos, and I was really interested in consumption and what we buy and what we're feeling when we buy it. And the dorm essentials market is a $1 billion industry that I was very interested in exploring. I just felt like a dorm would be the perfect place to think about how money works. Within a place that assumes that everyone is the same, there's like this facade that everyone is working from the same places because they're all in the same classrooms and eating at the same places and whatnot, but it's very, very different for everyone.
Yeah. I'm curious to know the transition between the two books. Obviously, you know, there's this notion called the sort of like sophomore curse, where it's like you have an incredibly successful...
I heard sophomore slump a lot.
Sophomore slump. But you had this incredibly successful first book. You know, it was a New York Times bestseller, and then it was longlisted for the Booker Prize.
Yeah.
So, like, how did you find your way into the material for the second book? And, like, how did this idea come to you?
The wonderful and terrible part about publishing is that it takes forever. So I sold Such a Fun Age, and it didn't come out till 18 months later. Mm-hmm. And so I started working on Come and Get It 10 months before Such a Fun Age came out, you know, and they say the best way to get over someone is to get under someone else. And so I just started working on something else, and I didn't really care about it as much. Your whole life as a writer, you're always writing, not thinking that you're going to get paid for it. And so I tried to really harness mm-hmm. that feeling. I am doing different things stylistically within Come and Get It than I did with Such a Fun Age. And I think that I had the peace and quiet to figure out those things. I did have a thesis advisor tell me, you already did the big book, so mm-hmm. now do the book for you that you get to do. So it's kind of like, I've been telling myself, like, it's like, I'm out past my curfew, and my parents found out, and they're like, we'll talk about this in the morning. And I'm like, but I'm already out, so I'm going to get fucked up. You know what I mean? Like, just do whatever I want to do with this book. And I think that this book was where I really wanted to put the blueprint of my brain and my interests on the page, and I'm super happy that I got to do that.
You mentioned some stylistic changes that between the first two books. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. On a sentence level, mm-hmm. I like to work in close third, but I got even closer, I feel, than in Such a Fun Age. Things were a little bit fragmented in the way that people think. I dip into Kennedy's mind really hard, mm-hmm. probably harder than the other two characters, even though you see her a little bit less. Mm-hmm. Letting pop culture references into the book was something I didn't do as much with Such a Fun Age. This book is very much a book about the nightmare of like buying things. And so I really let that really take over the book. Mm-hmm. Not everyone wants to read like descriptions of a dorm room, but I could read those all day long. My editor did pull me back a lot with those. And I think because of the way that I researched by interviewing a lot mm-hmm. of people for this book, the dialogue took a turn and I wanted to just draw people in like a docuseries almost and give a little bit more effort to how people actually speak. And so if you've ever transcribed anything, you know that people don't speak chronologically. They go in and out and they say, oh my gosh, yeah, no, like, and it was a balance between making those idioms not grating, but still paying homage to how they work in real life. I think those ways were intensified in this novel.
Yeah, you did an incredible job. I mean, the shifts in perspective were so well done, okay. and everyone's voice was so clear. And I'm curious about voice and how you developed this, all the voices here. I mean, there's like an incredible cast of characters of maybe like 10 or 15. Like, they're like yeah. maybe 5 or 6 college students, and then a few other people, yeah. including one of the main protagonists. How did you manage the cast of character, and how did you find a voice for each person?
Reading other works was really beneficial in terms of that. So I got lucky, and things were very neat this time, and each of my main characters was inspired by another work. Mm-hmm. So Agatha, firstly, was inspired by a book called Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. And it's written by two mm-hmm. sociologists who did a 5-year study on young women at a Midwestern university and their finances or socioeconomic backgrounds and the opportunities afforded to them later. I think reading an academic work of people interviewing students the right way helped me get into the voice of Agatha. Of course, in the beginning, I let a friend read some pages, and she was like, no, this is what you would think is funny. This isn't mm-hmm. what she would think is funny. You need mm-hmm. to back up. Mm-hmm. So there's a little pull and push, but reading actual academic works helped me get into Agatha's head a bit. For Millie, I was really inspired by this book called Knocking the Hustle Against the Turn in Neoliberal Black Politics by Lester Spence. I don't know if you've read it. It's so mm-hmm. good. I don't even know how to describe it. There's civil rights, there's the inevitability politics we're pushed into, there's hustle culture, and it's really beautiful. And Millie is a hustler. She believes that by working hard, she'll get what she wants. And there was a chapter at a faith, finance, and family summit, and everyone was encouraged to chant, I am a millionaire in the making. And there was something about that sparked Millie's voice and just kept me there. Mm-hmm. And then I read a book called Monoculture, How One Story is Changing Everything, written by F.S. Michaels. And it's a book that's about capitalism, but she calls it the economic story. And she talks about how the economic period we're in like, infiltrates every level of our lives, from like how we communicate, our relationships, everything. And there's this one part where she talks about how within a class society, we look at ourselves and the people around us, and we say, like, you're a rational person, and the decisions that you make for yourself are because you know it's the best decision. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, and it's like going to a Chinese food restaurant, like the good kind that has like 400 things on the menu, and you've only ordered three of them, but you're like, no, those are my favorite. Mm-hmm. But you actually don't know what your favorite thing is, and we're a bit crippled by that choice and what it says about us. So that's where Kennedy was born from. And I tried to combine all the interviews I did with this crippling choice and make a really neurotic, lonely student. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you take on like some huge topics and huge themes in the book, you know, critique of capitalism and issues in higher education and consumption. And it's all like, it doesn't feel heavy handed.
Oh, good.
And I'm just wondering, like, just sort of like how you approached that part of things. You know, you're reading all of these nonfiction texts, it's really heady stuff, and how did you work to massage those themes in the book without having the ideas overtake the story?
That's a really good point, because I personally don't love fiction that masks sociology, and that's like shoving something down your throat. Mm-hmm. I really don't love it. The things that really stood out to me within nonfiction works that I was most inspired by are always quotes from real people. There was a quote within Paying for the Party, the young woman saying, all the cool girls on my floor have big puffy coats. I want a big puffy coat. And I just thought, ah, oh, there was just something so tender within that. And so I think that that does more of the work than like me explaining, you know, the depths of capitalism or anything. Mm-hmm. And I also just don't think that's my bag completely.
Yes.
I love being inspired by pieces like that. I love taking art and saying, okay, I like this poem. What does the novel version of this poem look like? I also think that focusing on individual people rather than like large issues is where the fiction comes. I don't like polemic books, so I try to focus us on how people would be living their lives.
Right, especially books about Black characters, which tend to be read as sociology as opposed to fiction or art. And so sometimes people are reading for like the bigger journalistic picture as opposed to reading these people as people.
Absolutely.
And so you definitely were able to pull that off in a really sophisticated way.
Thank you.
And so you mentioned that there were some stylistic shifts between the two books, and that you're covering different geography, literally and metaphorically, but you're still very much interested in both of your books in dynamics, interpersonal relationships between women in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and this sort of intergenerational relationship between women. And I'd love to know more about that and what interests you about those dynamics.
That's a really good question. There's something, it's not that I don't like men or anything like that, but I do think that I'm super interested in money. And I think that the way that money and things are marketed towards women, particularly in that age, is very distinctive. And I mean, when you walk into Target is a big part of this book. There's that section that's like girls' nights and like book club and you need a tumbler and a face mask and like, that's being all marketed like towards women. And I think that I was really fascinated by how money works within a women's sphere, because I feel like there's so many more things to buy when you're a woman. So I think that's a huge part of it. I'm definitely interested in the jobs that are foisted on women, particularly caring for another person. So many young girls, it's like, oh, do you want to babysit? And I feel like boys don't often get asked those things, and whether they have like a caring, you know, nurturing, like instinct or not, they just get pushed into those things. Both of these novels have young women who are in caregiver roles that many people see as temporary and say like, oh, but what are you going to do after this is done, when really they're doing extremely hard work. I'm also really interested in women who have to do jobs where they're mentally on all the time. I was an RA for 1 year, and I remember like a woman, someone could just knock on my door like anytime and be like, I'm having a fight, or I'm homesick or whatever. And you had to be there for, I think I got $700 a semester in room and board or something. I think those jobs are really fascinating, and how they're viewed is a problem. And so I'm very interested in jobs that are seen as character building, and seen as something that should be temporary, but definitely isn't. Yeah.
It feels like there's a resonance, you know, in terms of caretaking and caregiving and character building, right? Between the jobs of the young women that you've written about. So in Such a Fun Age, Amira was a babysitter, and in Come and Get It, one of the main characters here, Millie, is a resident advisor. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know, like, what you think the relationship between caregiving and novel writing is. And also, I mean, obviously character development is a big part of writing novels, but like, what about care? What is the novelist's relationship to care?
That is a great question. The novels that I want to read have a generous and diplomatic approach to their characters. I did some satirical elements in Such a Fun Age. I did not want to do that here. I was not interested in making fun of young people and saying, like, look at these dumb kids. I don't think they're dumb, and I enjoy listening to anybody speak in a certain platform. The novels that I want to read present characters at their worst and at the top of their intelligence and show me how good they can be as people and what they value as well. And I think that when you present characters at their best, when they mess up, it hits even harder. I do think it's an artist's job to tell the truth. And to be a good writer, I do think that you have to be a good listener. So there are some threads between being a good caretaker and listening and being a writer as well. It's funny because I don't think it's an artist's job to hold a reader's hand, but I do think it's an artist's job to get their reader to listen. It's kind of like the equivalent of showing a child how to clean up and not cleaning up everything for them. I think that there's care there involved and like an artist's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's also a critique of certain methods of journalism and the ethics of journalism in the mm-hmm. book, right? And questions of care are also related to that thread in the book as well. You mentioned that you wrote for a magazine and you did interviews for this book too.
I did.
So like, what was that that process like, conducting interviews and having this critique of journalism and ethics in your mind as you're doing it? Like, how did you navigate all of that?
Okay, I want to be clear that when I wrote for a magazine, I was literally like, there's a new like flower store opening. Like, it was like,
still journalism.
It was still journalism, but it was not like what you do at all. But for this book, I started out very much the way Agatha started out. Mm-hmm. And from what I had read in books, I was not faking to be being a socialist, a sociologist. Mm-hmm. But, a little Freudian stuff there. But I just sat down with young women, and I paid them $15 for 45 minutes of their time. And I asked questions like, where do you get your money? When you ask your father for money, what's the language that you use? What's your rent? If someone's going to pay you back, how do they pay you? And I have to say they were so open to answering those questions. Everyone I interviewed wanted to make sure that I knew that they would never talk about those things openly because that's really gauche to them, but they are super interested in money. Of course, people would say things that were classist and racist, and it's not my job in that role in the moment to say, like, that's wrong or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I was interviewing a young woman and asking about her sorority, and I asked about the black fraternity and sorority that were also on campus, and she was talking about recruitment process. And I said, okay, are the black sororities and fraternities involved in the same process? And she said, oh, no, it's just the normal ones. And she caught herself and went, and it's my job in that moment, I feel, to just, like, let her do what she wants. But as a writer, I get so much from that correction. And I want to try to recreate that feeling within my writing. So I did not do a lot of, I had like some journalist friends that I would ask for advice, and there was a couple of pieces of literature that I read, but mostly I just let people talk and listened. And I'm really gracious that they did that with me.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between listening? I'm sure there is, but I would love to hear the difference in your mind between listening to real people and listening to characters. What's the difference there?
Okay, so this is a hard one. Because there are books that I really enjoy where the characters do not speak like real people. Mm-hmm. I reread The Secret History when I was pregnant. It is so good still. Mm-hmm. But those characters do not speak like 20-year-olds that you meet in the real world.
Yeah.
I do feel like there's a responsibility on an author to make sure that your characters and the way that they speak is still true to them and not like serving a plot in any way. And I love plot, but I think you have to be true to what your character would do within that moment. I also feel that what a character is doing with their hands and their body is also speaking for them. So sometimes it's letting them not speak as well. That's a really hard one. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, some writers will talk about their process of, like, it's almost sort of like they're channeling, you know, characters from beyond or from, you know, some other realm. You know, that they're just the conduits for the voice.
Okay, I know. Okay. what do you think of that?
I don't know. I believe that some people are literally sort of feeling themselves as vessels for the language. Mm-hmm. But then I also think that there is labor involved in crafting voice, you know, and it's not all just passing through the writer, that it's a thing about craft. It's something that has to be developed. Dialogue has to be developed. Your dialogue is so crisp. Mm-hmm. And great here. Like, how do you? I've never been good at dialogue when I tried to write fiction. It was like the hardest thing for me. And I know that you're supposed to push through the things that are harder and develop those things. And I just had the hardest time with voice and dialogue. And so I was just curious about that. Yeah.
And I have to write anything nonfiction, I'm like in tears. So I mm-hmm. can't really do what you do mm-hmm. as well. I did study theater for a long time in undergraduate school. I was in an acting program at Marymount Manhattan College, and I read a lot of scripts, and I was doing that with a religious studies minor, and so I was reading a lot of scripts next to religious texts all the time, and I think that something happened in my brain a little bit where I wanted to hear what these things sounded like. I'm just nosy, too, and I just want to hear what people are talking about, and there's something... Okay, this is going to be a crazy thing to say, but... I feel like a wormhole like forms within your brain when you can hear someone saying something the way that you see it on the page. And whether you're like, I've done that, I know that person, I've seen that gesture, and there's like a connection that forms that is so elusive but meaningful right in that moment. And I'm always trying to get that exact moment. I think the perfect gesture will break your heart in a perfect way when someone's nervous or trying something new, and I'm just always searching for those moments.
Yeah. You do such an incredible job of weaving together. Like, there are a bunch of interesting repetitions in the book, and there's these really interesting ways in which people will, like, say a phrase, and then you'll see other people repeat that phrase throughout the book. And I'm just wondering how you sort of managed... It's almost like these ideas or these repetitions of phrases and language, almost like memes in a way.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm just curious about, like, following the thread of all of those things throughout the book and how you kept yourself organized as you were writing.
Yes. I do plot things out. I write everything down of, like, the first time someone says something when it's repeated, the first time the dishes are left. I do plot all those things out. When I am plotting things out, if everything is going according to plan, I know something's wrong, though. It's just I have to follow the story and what the characters are feeling. And there was a big moment in Such a Fun Age where for 2 years I thought Amira would be talking to Alex in Alex's apartment during this one moment when she's really upset. And then when I got to that scene, I was like, she would never leave her apartment. She's upset. What are you talking about? So I have to change things around. Some of those moments will find you as the writer. And you think, oh, she would definitely think of this moment. And some of them you kind of plot out a bit. I do think a novel should be entertaining. Those are the kind of books that I like to read, so I definitely try to schedule them when it will hit the reader the hardest. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You talk a little bit about, there's this incredible idea that you raise in the book called pleasure deprivation.
Yes.
And I'm curious about your relationship to pleasure deprivation, because I know writing a book, you said it took 4 years to write this book. And so, like, what is it like sort of, I know writing can be grueling and really, really difficult. And, like, how did that idea or that idea come to you, and how do you manage that in your own life?
My very good friend, Megan Angelo, who is in this room right now, who is also a writer, she once referred to herself as a pleasure deprivation maven. And this is why, because she's a brilliant author, and myself and her do this thing where we're like, okay, you are not allowed to get a haircut until you make it to chapter 5. You're not allowed to do that. When you make it to this thing, then you can do it. But, like, you have to deny yourself all pleasures first. And I think that that's something that we all do. I wanted to combine that familiar sensation with consumption and how we go to buy something when we feel bad. There's so much in our language of like, oh, I deserve it. It's a little treat. I remember during the pandemic when people would say, it was so odd. It was like people were applying diet language to how they were living their lives all the time. They would say, well, we went to a restaurant, but we'd been so good. We deserve it. We had like stayed in so many times. I'm like, what are we doing? This is so weird the way that we're talking about this. So I think that combining the pleasure deprivation with consumption was a really interesting notion to explore here. I think the pleasure really comes from buying things. I think during the pandemic, we all saw like people desperate to go to restaurants. And I just had this feeling of like, why are we so desperate to have people serve us? Like, why is that the thing that you're like, I miss someone like bringing me a plate? Like, what is that doing to us? And so that was something I wanted to explore here. Yeah.
Yeah. I think pleasure deprivation and consumption also feels a little bit related to some of the friendships and the relationships in the book, right? There are all different types of desire in the book. And you sort of map them in very incredibly fascinating ways. So we have like people who are longing for a connection and friendship, and people who are interested in like romantic connections with others. And, and so often like, you know, these relationships are between women, you know, older women, younger women. And I'm just interested in desire and just would like to know more about desire as a theme in this book.
Yes. I think that desire exists between women on so many different levels. Sometimes it's romantic, and sometimes it's because you want to be somebody. Sometimes it's because you want what they want. This novel also explores the phenomenon of when you get a new job and there's mean friends there and you feel yourself becoming mean. I think the desire to belong with other people and feel young is something that I wanted to explore. I think that we are often humiliated by what we want, if that makes sense. Like you find your, like, I found that when I was, sometimes when I was reading my peers' work when I was in graduate school, I felt that people were writing down their fantasies, and it humiliated me to be reading it. I remember someone wrote a scene where it was a person who was just like them walking into a room, and everyone was like, we missed you. You're so wonderful. Come sit by us. And you could just, I was like, "You, this is your fantasy. This is crazy. And you're just writing it in there. And I think wanting things is something that as you grow older, you feel that you have to add an etiquette to. I have a 1.5-year-old, and when she wants something, she wants it. Like, that is it. And I wonder where that goes. And I'm so interested in the propriety around wanting something and why we want those things. This was a novel where I wanted to explore the combination of those things when you're like, I want to be you, but I also want you to like me, but I want you to want to kiss me, but I want all of those things at once. I never think that they're just one thing, and yeah, there's a lot of desire.
There's a fine line between loving someone and consuming them, right? Consuming their personality and their interests and their language. And I'm really interested, you were talking about propriety just now, and you know, as I mentioned before, like there's a critique of journalistic ethics and the ways in which some of those ethics are abused or sort of not where people with responsibility and authority are not sort of living up to that.
Right.
And there's a critique of storytelling, right? And who gets to tell someone else's story? And as a novelist, I mean, you're literally telling stories, right? And sometimes, I don't know, people get their material, but it's just from living life, right? And I'm sure there are maybe some composite characters in here and some, you know, different experiences that you're sort of culling from. And so I'd like to know what your, how you feel about permission as a fiction writer, and then the question of permission and who gets access to other people's stories and who gets to tell those stories. How do you manage that yourself?
For this novel, it was really important to respect the people that I interviewed. They were extremely excited at the idea of something that they said ending up in the novel. Mm-hmm. But it was very important for me to not have any likeness at all or be poking fun at them and make sure that character that said something terrible on one page said something really intelligent on another page. But I think permission is really fascinating. Like, all the time, like, a pop star will come out with a song that's terrible about someone else, and everyone just, like, knows who that is, and it's just chill. We just, like, all know who they're talking about. And within the novel, Millie will sometimes copy the speech of one of her girlfriends and pretend like it's her own. On one end, we all do that all the time. That's how trends start and fade. We're always taking things from one another. Of course, there's journalistic ethics, but I'm not sure where I fall in terms of fiction. It's a fiction writer's job to tell the truth, but I don't think that I favor exploitive fiction or me taking someone's entire trajectory with their boyfriend and without talking to them, asking them. This was a book about asking permissions for sure and making sure that these things were okay to share with everyone else. I don't believe in taking people's lives for the sake of art. I just don't. If it's not their thing to share, then I wouldn't share those things. But I do think that we're taking things from other people all the time.
Yeah,
I wanted to explore that a bit here too.
And I could see a little bit of a sort of the conversation and the discourse around cultural appropriation a little bit in the book as well, but mm-hmm. sort of, again, not done in a ham-fisted way, but to treat it very intelligently.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think I have time for one more question.
Okay.
Before we hand it over to the audience. So I guess I wanted to ask a question about endings, which I guess is appropriate, right? Since it's my last question. You have a knack for, like, writing these incredibly comic, high wire set pieces. So readers of Such a Fun Age will remember the Thanksgiving scene and how fun that was to read. And you have a few of those in this book. And so I'm interested in, like, your interest in characters coming together in these really elaborate ways and kind of the intricacy of people meeting and connecting and misunderstanding each other.
Yes. It's a true joy to have those meetings of all of the characters that you've been mm-hmm. crafting this entire time. But you have a huge responsibility to stay true to who they've been the entire novel. And it should work in a way of you saying, like, of the reader going, of course she would do, oh great, now this person coming in, oh of course they would do that. And so you have to follow up with all of those things. Mm-hmm. Choreography is so important in those moments. I wish I could say, like, I'm having, like, a ton of fun when I'm writing those scenes, but, like, it's mm-hmm. so much choreography. The Thanksgiving scene in Such a Fun Age where people were sitting was really difficult. I kept losing babies when they were sitting. It was just a mess at first. And I had to do the same thing here as well. I turn a bit clinical when I'm writing these scenes because I want to nail this melding of all of these characters. They take a really long time to add everyone's dialogue and make sure that everyone's getting a fair shot, but also keeping the reader completely engrossed. Point of view is really hard in those scenes because sometimes you'll write an entire active scene from one person's perspective, and that's the thing that tells you actually somebody else's point of view is much more interesting there. But you wouldn't have got there unless you did it from the other person's perspective. They take a really long time, but I hope they are successful here. Yeah,
I mean, the ending was just really special, and it kind of brought all of the threads together in a really compelling way.
Oh, good. So, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Of course. So I think we are ready to take questions from the audience.
Hey, thanks for being here. I love Such a Fun Age, and I'm so stoked to read this one. What's your revision process like? You just talked about the Thanksgiving scene. Did it all come first, or you talk about the clinical detail? Did you have to go back and rearrange? I'd just love to hear about your revision process.
Sure.
Thanks.
Going back and back and back and back and back. And of course, with the first novel, you're selling the entire novel. So you want to get it as perfect as you can. When I get a full body of work, I just go over it and over it and over it. And if you have this concentrated time, the book in your brain just becomes smaller in this really great way where you can see connections that you can make that you didn't before. I stayed in my room for weeks and worked 8 hours a day just reading it and reading it and reading it. My husband would put little bowls of soup outside my door, and I would knock and, like, snack over it and just keep going. It's really intense. A professor of mine said something that really stuck with me was just to have a really guided read each time. Okay, so this time when I'm reading it, I'm going to read it for Briar. Okay, this time when I'm reading, I'm going to read it for the dorm and make sure the setting is perfect. And just, like, having a post-it up, reminding myself why I'm reading it that time and really making notes for that one specific thing. Of course, later getting an editor, you have someone to do it with you, which is great. But in that first draft, It's honestly going over it and over it until it sounds perfect. And it's also reading it aloud, I think, which is humiliating when you're doing it in your room. But you have to read it out loud to make sure that these things are sounding the way that you want them to sound. And if you're tripping up over something, I think that's a problem. I do overwrite a bit and then try and pull back. I think that it's best to throw everything out and then see what sticks. I wish it was more fancy than just doing it over and over again. Yeah.
Thanks for coming back to Philadelphia.
You're welcome.
I'm curious, if I'm not trying to put you on the spot about your next project, but I love both of your books, and I was really interested in what you were saying about Target and like going in there and how everything is like for women to have like a girls' night, and as a new mother, also a new mother, as you know. There's a lot of stuff marketed at new mothers, like even wine, which is very problematic in my opinion. Yeah. Like mommy needs her chill out juice or whatever. And I know you have obviously covered themes of motherhood in Such a Fun Age especially, but I'm curious if that is something you think you'd want to like delve deeper into in future work, or if you think like there's anything there, I guess.
I think the mommy consumption line is fascinating. I would be shocked if it didn't show up somewhere. I was just, because, you know, as a mom, we bought all the books and we read like two chapters of them, you know, and I was reading about how for hundreds of years, most children from like super low income to super wealthy all played with the same toys. It was like you're going outside and you're playing and you're building and like rocks and whatever. And then after the Industrial Revolution, it was like, oh, no, toys are educational. Like, do you want your kid to be smart? Well, you better buy them these blocks or whatever it is. And so now it's just like all this stuff for moms and the guilt of like, well, you better buy this thing for your kid. So I am really interested in tracking those flows. I'm also super obsessed with like the pipeline of like, what do they call it? When you buy, when people market to, when you do something in a certain setting, like, you know how you only have like tomato juice, like on an airplane or whatever, like those things, they're marketing that towards moms a lot. Like when you throw your kids in the thing, you do this. And then when you're done breastfeeding, you do this. And like, I think those things for mothers are fascinating. I definitely see mothers in the future, the feeling of being like obsessed with my child. Like I want to explore that in writing a little bit one day. So yeah, it's definitely possible, I'll say. Yeah.
When you were deciding who to interview on, I assume, college campuses, did you have people come to you? Did you seek them out? And I know that there's places on college campuses that maybe certain kinds of people hang out, people of different socioeconomic statuses hang out. How did you make those choices on who to interview and what to be asking these people?
Okay, that's a great question. No one came to me. I was such a creep. I was just like trying to find people. At first, I was also really nervous. I had interviewed people for Such a Fun Age, but it was always like the friend of a friend, or I needed someone who worked at the like USDA office and I knew someone who knew someone, but these were strangers. So a few of my students who were no longer my students, I reached out and said, I'm doing this project. Would you like to be interviewed? And a few of them said yes. And then one of them said, me and my roommates are always talking about money things. And I said, would they talk to me? And she said, yeah. And I actually wrote about this more in the foreword of The Great Gatsby's latest edition, about that entire experience. I wanted to interview students of different socioeconomic backgrounds, and a lot of them that were in my classes were in sororities and had came from a lot of money. I asked friends if they had students who worked. And so I quickly met a young woman who worked full-time at a grocery store while she was in school and got her perspective. The person that I got my Starbucks from sometimes within the Hy-Vee grocery store was very young, and she allowed me to interview her as well. I just went to random ass people who would talk to me. But I have to say, like, I was just telling Nahila about this. Most people are so, like, when you want to ask about their lives, are so giving and just like, yeah, of course. I do think, like, that's one wonderful. And I also think people are lonely and aren't used to people asking them about their lives a little bit. And the young woman I interviewed from Starbucks was like, why would you want to interview me? I don't understand. And she was someone who told me that
her mom would take her and her five brothers and sisters to the dollar store every Christmas, and they would all get to shop for one of them, and one of them would wait inside the bus, and they would all go shop for one, and then they would switch, and that went right into the novel. It was beautiful. So that was the students. As far as everyone else, when I was just in my optometrist office, I was like, can I talk to you about glaucoma for a little bit? I reached out to people via email, and most people got back to me, and most people turned down my payment and just said, no, donate it somewhere. I just contacted as many people as I could. If you were a writer, I will say, like, I was really shocked that people were as giving as they were. Yeah.
Love the book. It's crazy. I'm from Maryland, and I went to Temple. It was crazy reading Such a Fun Age.
But, oh, amazing. That was perfect.
Yeah. But my question, as an artist, how do you navigate through, like, creative, like, blockages, if you have them, and, like, finding new inspiration, like, for your new works and stuff? That's it.
Yes. Okay. So I'm usually on the other side where I want to do too much and I want to calm down. However, in the times that I need something new, there's a few things. One, going back to my favorite books and opening up the first or last chapter and see what they did. Just poking my head in like other books and seeing what was up there. The biggest thing that gets me out of a block is I'm like, okay, this is a week that I'm going to call a research week. I'm not going to write about these things anymore. I'm going to go to the experts. So if I'm like obsessed with jealousy that week, and like what movies are about jealousy, like who studies them, is there like a podcast about jealous roommates, I'm just gonna like infiltrate myself with other media for that week. I don't like to push it, you know what I mean? I don't know if I like to like force myself to write if it's really just not flowing, but I don't think it's wise to like dig around on your phone when it doesn't work, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's wise to just turn to something else. Some of my writing days are just me sitting and staring and just thinking about what I want to write, and counting that as a writing day too. But I do think the biggest thing is going to different media forms and searching out the experts and what you're interested in. Yeah.
Hi, thanks for coming back to Philly. So I'm interested in time, place, and title. So I see this one takes place in 2017. So why that? And I think you mentioned you went and lived in Arkansas for a year. You could share a little bit, I'm assuming it was for research for the book. And then also the title, I remember for Such a Fun Age, you said like that was the first title that you thought of for it. And then you like I think so. You brainstormed, you sat in Uncle Bobby's in Germantown, and you like the publisher said, we want more ideas. Yes. We're not convinced, that's it. And then you came up with like a time.
I'm glad you remember. Thank you.
So wondering about coming up with the title for this one. I already love it, just knowing like what the book is about, but because you're you know, think about words a lot. So
thank you for coming to both. Yes, that was the title and they fought me on it, and I did go sit at Uncle Bobby's and I won. Okay. Time, 2017 is this novel. Honestly, I lived there just trying to get into grad school, and the place made a really big impact on me then. Truthfully, I had intended to do a lot more trips back to Fayetteville when I was writing, but the pandemic happened. And so it was me going on Google image search and making sure I had everything perfect from that year. I was like, let's just commit to 2017 as you remembered it, which I think was actually smart in the long run because there's such big turnover in a big college school. So I just wanted it how it was then. So that is time. Place, I was just there. And I think that Fayetteville is really interesting because in my research, I interviewed a lot of people who live in the South, and they would all say the same thing, which was, oh, Fayetteville, that's not really the South, though. Like, Clemson, that's the South. Auburn, that's the South. Fayetteville, that's like Denver. I was like, what are you talking about? And so I think that places that are geographically Southern but not under the philosophy of Southern are really interesting. And then seeing people who are trying to, like, up those Southern values and other people who are trying to deny them is really interesting as well. A lot of people in the book talk about, like, they're always asked, like, does she have an accent? And it's like, no, it's just people living in this place. And I think that the fact that Fayetteville was such a bubble within Northwest Arkansas was really interesting, but it's also was really beautiful. So I was happy to go there mentally. Time, place, and title. I did not have a title for this for the longest time. And then for 2 years, I wanted to name it Suey. I thought, because the Arkansas like hog call is Woo Pig Suey, I thought that name was like weirdly violent and great, and I really wanted it. And then whenever I would say it to anyone, they would say Shooey Zooey, and like no one could get it. And I was like, maybe this isn't gonna work. And I was texting with my agent, and she said, well, what does Suey mean? It's like a hog call. It's like, here, pig, come and get it. And that was it. Mm. Yeah.
This is probably a lame question. You probably get it a lot. But I guess, like, you talked about going back to your favorite books. What are they? Like, and what are your, like, what older authors, like, inspire you, and ones that are current and ones that are unknown that we rarely get to read? I know this a lot. But.
That's a great ending question. That's great. Going back, I feel a little cheesy, but I love Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin. Like, everyone's like, we know. It's like, but yeah, the character of Hella in that book is just like always does something to me. I love Giovanni's Room a lot. I just started getting into J.M. Coetzee. Have you read?
Mm-hmm.
Disgrace is, it's incredible. In terms of like a plot moving, Coetzee really knows what he's doing. Like I said, I recently reread The Secret History. It's just, it knocks me out. A new work that I just read that really knocked me out was Worry by Alexandra Tanner. It's out in March. And I love that book. Did you ever read Special Topics in Calamity Physics?
No.
It's a good one. There's just, what she's doing in that book, it's so creative. And I don't even want to say anything else on that one. That one really gets me. And also The Factory by Hiroko Oyamada is really wonderful as well. I'm teaching a class right now called The Workplace Novel. And so I get to reread a lot of my favorite books about work. And this is a book about a factory where young people go to work and they're doing really odd tasks like editing memos and then immediately shredding them, and dark birds are hovering over the building, and that's all I'll say on that. Yeah, those are the ones I would suggest.
I think that's all the time we have.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you all for being here. I think Uncle Bobby's is selling books outside.
Thank you. This is really lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.